What can we learn from those who decided not to follow Jesus? Hello, I am Dave Thomas, Dean of the School of Theology, and this is The Good Word, our weekly dialogue on things biblical. Today, I have two conversational partners, Daryl Bigger, a colleague from the School of Theology, and Larry Viverka, also a colleague. Gentlemen, we are here today to talk about people who did not follow Jesus. And, you know, we have been talking in weeks past about those who did follow Jesus, some of them who followed very quickly. But today we talk about those who did not follow. And there are in the Gospels a number of examples. I think, first of all, of Matthew, the 8th chapter, there is a record of a teacher of the law who came to Jesus. And if you read the story, it's kind of interesting because in an almost exuberant sense, it seems to indicate that he volunteered and said to Jesus, "I will follow you wherever you go." And yet he ends up not following. In Matthew 8, again, a little bit later, we have the person who is kind of undescribed, a nondescript person who came, but talked about wanting to go and bury his father. And that comment I find interesting in view of the custom of the time that the dead were buried on the same day that they died. Of course, then there's the story of the rich young ruler in Mark chapter 10, a man who believed himself to be in very good spiritual condition, but Jesus found a chink in his armor that caused him to turn away. And I'm wondering, what can we learn from these? Is there any value in this, or do we just consign them to the scrap heap of history and sorrow over them?
Well, the point certainly seems to be very clear, and that is, if this is not your primary commitment, it's not good enough.
Okay. So you bring up what might be called the cost associated with discipleship. Mm.
And the willingness to sacrifice relationships, comfort, priorities, business, friendships, all of those things, if you're not willing to give them up, then you really haven't absolutely committed yourself to God.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So in many cases, these are illustrations of ways in which we may not have completely relinquished all we are and have to our discipleship of Christ.
Yeah, I've been just pondering, wondering, what's the common theme here? And again, I guess I agree, Daryl. I think it's about what would stand in the way or what would prevent us from a total commitment to following Jesus. And there are illustrations. These are all illustrations of the sorts of things that can get in the way, that would detract detour people away from Christ.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in thinking of that man who came and exuberantly offered himself, saying, "I will follow you ever," Jesus' response is kind of interesting. He said, "Foxes have dens to live in, and the birds have nests. But I, the Son of Man, have no home of my own, not even a place to lay my head." And that was enough to apparently discourage this man in spite of his exuberance. I noticed that there's a difference between these people and Nicodemus, and I bring Nicodemus in here because at least in an initial sense, it seems that he did not follow Jesus. Now, there are some evidences, as we have already mentioned some time ago, that Nicodemus became a follower of Jesus. But in the beginning, he kind of stood aloof. And yet, the treatment Jesus gave to Nicodemus is very different from the treatment he gave to the rich young ruler and this teacher of the law. Why do you think that's the case? Is there any significance to that?
I'm not so sure the treatment is different.
Oh, you're not so sure?
No.
Oh, you're rejecting
no.
my premise, Larry.
Yeah. Because Nicodemus comes as one of the 70 best families in Palestine, selected by virtue of both social status, wealth, and moral upstandingness in the community to serve the country on the Sanhedrin. And Jesus undresses him. I mean, it just absolutely reverses the whole business of what he's coming in and tells him he must be born again. He's got to start all over again in some sense. And Nicodemus, three times, as Jesus leads the conversation toward what's involved in being having one's heart healed, has Nicodemus sputtering. I mean, it's really the other fellow obviously has the flaw, the chink in his armor, as you put it, point out his own desire for what Nicodemus had. Nicodemus is one who's already there, in a sense, and there's a contrast. But it's still about the same sorts of issues.
Interesting.
Well, then maybe I should rephrase my premise a little bit, because certainly the results of the encounter with Jesus for Nicodemus and these other people is very different. And, I mean, are there some insights to be drawn from that side? Because, you know, if I do agree with you that Nicodemus was pretty shocked when by the time the conversation was over. He was very surprised, because the things that he thought he could rely on in terms of redemption were destroyed. They were dismantled in front of his eyes.
Right.
And now what? See? But there is a difference that Nicodemus shows up again in history. Mm-hmm. These other people disappear from history.
One thing that it suggests to me should be an encouragement, I think, to those who need to process new ideas for a while before they advocate them. There are those, and psychologists describe them in different kinds of categories, who can make up their mind quite quickly, who can change their way of life fairly easily. And there are others who need to integrate these new things over a period of time before they become part of themselves. And I see Jesus in this case nudging and raising the issues, but still allowing the time for that new idea to be nurtured and grow and develop and lead then to a decision later on. So I don't think all responses have to be immediate.
No.
Yeah.
But you know, in the first three individuals whom we mentioned, there seems to be no response. There seems to be simply a turning away.
Yeah.
And those people, I think, go into history in as tragic figures, because at least from a Christian perspective, they are on the borders of the kingdom. They are about to find a whole new life, and they walk away from it, and that's kind of tragic.
Mm. We all see students that illustrate those two different kinds of responses in classes, don't we? Some who say, oh yes, or oh no, and others who say, but what about this, and how does that fit with that idea? And it raises more questions for them than it simply resolves.
You know, there's another example. The ones we've talked about here involve individuals, but there's another well-known example where Jesus went up to Nazareth, and he went into the synagogue there, and he participated, in fact, even in reading and teaching. And when he began to apply some of the what we call messianic prophecies to himself, there was a group rejection of him. Any lessons to draw from that? This is different from the quiet departure of one person here. They actually became hostile and tried to haul him out. I mean, they hauled him out to the edge of the cliff and were about to throw him down, and he walked quietly away. So you're looking philosophical, Larry. You must have something.
Well, it's an interesting situation. I mean, Jesus already knew he was set up when he went there. You know, a prophet's not welcome in his own country. He knew their expectations of him were different from what he understood himself to be. They were all quite ready and willing, I think, to get on the messianic bandwagon of a revolt against Rome. Fascinating when he preaches, he sort of reads the text and comments on it, that he stops in the middle of the verse, you know. And I don't know. It just seems like he's almost intentional in the way he goes about antagonizing them. He really puts them to the test. mm-hmm. when he points out how that these non-Jewish folk were much more appreciative of God's messages and his prophets than his own, than they as a people had been in their history. And so he just completely turns a deaf ear to the whole anticipation of the great day of the Lord and the day of God's vengeance and going to put things right and put these foreigners in their place. And in some ways, I don't know, I think their reaction to him would be predictable. And whether he's intentional in evoking that with its, you know, with its consequence, or whether he was, my guess is too that there's a certain amount of history of the times that he's come through Nazareth and dealt with them that he's bringing to this occasion as well. So it's an interesting thing though to look at this whole story.
And yet, you know, there is, I wonder when I read the story too about the effect of what we sometimes call a herd mentality. I wonder how many people they actually had given thoughtful reaction to this and how many of them just got caught up in the movement of the masses.
It's one of the most frightening things for me when I think about myself and other human beings. If you look back at history, at how frequently we have reinterpreted what happened at the time, and how few people who lived through those times saw it as we can see it after the fact. It's at least humbling, if not frightening, to me about my own ability to see clearly through God's eyes today instead of through the eyes of the culture and society in which I live.
And so any lessons we can draw here? I don't know if you...
Well, Jesus provides a good example of not going and doing the expected, not placating people with what they want to hear. Mm-hmm. He's absolutely and determined to be honest, to be truthful, mm-hmm. to be transparent. And that's refreshing to me, and I really admire that. I think there's a danger, obviously, in being too provocative and losing your cause or your audience in that sense. But he did. I mean, he really did lose his audience, and they turned hostile. Yeah.
And for me, I take it as an appeal for me to be a silent, reflective searcher for what God wishes for me today, and not just a reflector of the world in which I live.
And I think we would all agree that there are some lessons to be learned about the cost of being a follower of Jesus, that, you know, it's not something that's not going to inconvenience you. It's not something that comes without any requirement. I don't mean salvation requirement, but it is going to kind of cross the grain of life. Any primary commitment we have is going to do that. And I guess what we are left to wonder, what can be done for those who almost accepted but didn't. So, but we're out of time, and I want to say again a word of thanks to Larry and Darrell for their presence here and their participation. Our thanks to our engineer, John Campbell. And our thanks to our audience. For Good Word, I'm Dave Thomas.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.